This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work Policy and Practice at the University of Chicago, where research meets real-world impact. The master's program in social work blends classroom learning with extensive field education guided by faculty known for groundbreaking research. Applications are open at crownschool.uchicago.edu/socialwork. Inspire change. Shape the future.
Thank you for supporting WBEZ. You keep public media public. December gifts are among the most important because they set the tone for our reporting in 2026. Next year, we're doubling down on bringing you stories that arm you with the facts. This journalism relies on everyone contributing what they can. Join them today at wbez.org/donate.
I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. Anyone born on American soil, regardless of their parents' immigration status, has a right to citizenship. It's been this way since 1868, when the 14th Amendment was ratified. Trump's been challenging birthright citizenship since day one, when he signed an executive order refusing the right to automatic citizenship if a child was born to parents without legal status. 22 states sued, and judges filed a national injunction. But now it's in the Supreme Court's hands to determine if Trump's order is constitutional. As the Supreme Court deliberates the future of birthright citizenship, we're diving into its history. Why do we have birthright citizenship in the United States? To answer that question and more, we spoke with Jane Hong, Associate Professor of History at Occidental College. She began with her reaction to Trump's challenge to birthright citizenship. Does she feel like we're going backwards in history? Here's the professor.
You know, I don't think I was very surprised. I think attacks on birthright citizenship aren't new. Over the past few decades, I feel like every presidential election cycle, there would be some discussion of so-called anchor babies, birth tourism, things along these lines. What is new, of course, is the executive order.
Yes.
That said, I think it's important to remember that constitutional amendments like the 14th Amendment can only be undone or changed by other constitutional amendments. And yes. So I think that's something to keep in mind.
Absolutely. And we'll get more into that. But I do want to go backwards a little bit and just talk about how we got here. That 14th Amendment that you just mentioned, it was enacted after the Civil War. Talk more, Jane, about its origins and who it originally applied to.
Yeah, this is a really important piece of the story. So birthright citizenship was enacted by Congress, as you mentioned, in the 14th Amendment. And the goal was to protect formerly enslaved African Americans. Because what many folks don't realize is that the 13th Amendment, following the Civil War, it abolishes slavery in the United States, but it doesn't actually say anything about what the status of Black Americans was going to be under the law, whether Black Americans would have legal protections, any kind of standing. And so the 14th Amendment was intended to ensure the legal protections and rights of formerly enslaved African Americans and free Blacks. And, you know, that's kind of where it began. Mm-hmm. But what's important to think about is that its protections and the rights that it gave effectively extended to everyone in the United States. So all persons, regardless of race, ethnicity, background. And that's been, I mean, birthright citizenship has been the foundation of multiracial democracy
right.
in the United States ever since.
Yeah. And in order for us to get to where it extended to everyone, it did go through some steps, right? So you sort of described there the 14th Amendment nullifying the 1857 Dred Scott decision. That ruled that the Constitution didn't extend citizenship to people of African descent, as you described. And so that was extremely significant. But then there is a lesser known part of the history, Jane, of birthright citizenship. This happened in 1898, and the ruling was U.S. versus Wong Kim Ark. Can you talk about who Wong Kim Ark was?
Sure. So Wong Kim Ark, he is a U.S.-born Chinese-American. He's born in San Francisco, California, in 1873 to Chinese immigrants. And this is actually before the Chinese Exclusion Act. So these are Chinese folks who immigrated early on. His father's a merchant. He has a store in San Francisco. It doesn't go very well, and so the business is not doing well. So they return to China, and they take Wong Kim Ark with them. And he, again, is a U.S.-born Chinese-American. And so under the 14th Amendment, under birthright citizenship, he is a U.S. citizen. They are in China, and Wong decides to come back to the United States because he just finds that he doesn't really have a lot of prospects in China. So he comes back to San Francisco. He works as a cook in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And then he goes back to China to, you know, visit his family in 1894. He brings all of his documentation, everything he needed, everything he thought he needed to get back into California later on. But when he comes back to San Francisco in the 1890s, he's denied entry and he's detained on the grounds that as a Chinese person, he is banned under the Chinese Exclusion Act. Mm-hmm. But he sues. He sues for his right to reenter the United States, and he gets help from a local Chinese American aid organization, the CCBA, the six companies in San Francisco. And so a lawyer representing the CCBA represents him in court and basically argues that, you know, Wong is a U.S. citizen and he has the right to habeas corpus, which guarantees people the right to defend themselves in a court of law. Mm-hmm. And it's basically a check against unlawful detention. And they take the case all the way up to the Supreme Court, basically arguing that Wong is a U.S. citizen and that his rights as a U.S. citizen were being violated.
Right.
And the Supreme Court actually upholds his case. They admit him. They readmit him to the United States on the basis that he is a U.S.-born American right. under birthright citizenship.
Yeah, the Supreme Court held in a 6-2 decision that because Wong Kim Ark was born in the U.S., he was indeed a U.S. citizen, and that Chinese Exclusion Act couldn't supersede the mandate of the 14th Amendment. We've mentioned the Chinese Exclusion Act, but can you just walk down that history path for us, Jane? Where did it start and why?
Yeah, so, you know, Chinese exclusion, it's passed in the 1880s, and there's actually a long series of laws. So the 1882 law is the best known, Chinese Exclusion Act. That law essentially, you know, bans laborers or workers from entering the United States, but it does admit all kinds of exempted classes. So merchants could enter the United States under special provisions, diplomats, temporary visitors, students, that kind of thing. But that law generally, it restricts Chinese from entering the United States. There had been previous laws in the 1870s, 1875, the Page Law had restricted Chinese women from entering the United States. And so, you know, Chinese are interesting because they are the only group in American history to be singled out under the law as an excludable group under law. Mm. And so it's both about Chinese being able to enter the United States as immigrants, but it's also about their eligibility to U.S. citizenship. And this is where, you know, Chinese and really all persons born in Asia, all persons of Asian descent are really singular because they are actually racially ineligible for U.S. citizenship under U.S. law.
Right.
And this doesn't actually change until 1952, which is when Congress passes a law making naturalization and U.S. citizenship race blind, basically. That's when racial restrictions are removed. But that's what makes birthright citizenship and the Wong Kim Ark case in the 1890s so important.
Yeah.
Because before the 1950s, essentially no one of Asian descent could become a U.S. citizen except through birthright citizenship.
Interesting. Yeah, the Wong Kim Ark case is complicated, especially because of the Chinese Exclusion Act being worked in there, but very, very pivotal at the time.
Yeah, definitely.
Now, from 1952, let's go to 1982. There's another development in how we sort of understand birthright citizenship the way that we do today. There's the case of Plyler versus Doe. What can you say about that one?
So this is a 1982 Supreme Court case where the Supreme Court rules that states cannot deny public education to undocumented children. And this case is centered in Texas, but it's, you know, it's not the only. So what I should say about that case is that the Supreme Court rules that this attempt to restrict public education to undocumented children, that it violates the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. And so you see how the 14th Amendment really is the basis of so much case law that we see, even in recent times. I should also say that there have been many other attacks on undocumented people. You know, I live in California, and one of the cases or one of the laws that my students and I regularly talk about is Proposition 187, which was a state proposition passed by California voters in 1994, which basically tried to bar undocumented people from being able to access all social services, including medical services and public education.
Yeah.
So California voters did actually pass that proposition, but it was overruled. It was basically deemed or ruled unconstitutional 3 days later. So there have been, there's been kind of a longer history of these kinds of attacks on undocumented Americans, especially under kind of state laws.
Yeah, which is why I'm so glad we're spending the time to talk about this today, because I think even, you know, some folks are hearing that this is the topic at the White House right now, you know, with an executive order being signed back in January, and not realizing that we've sort of had to battle with this in the past, or battle to keep this, keep things the way they were in the past. This is just, it's never gone this far. And it does seem, Jane, like birthright citizenship is inextricably tied to racial equality in the U.S. Would you agree?
Yes, I would 100% agree with that. So I think, you know, again, birthright citizenship really begins with the effort to protect formerly enslaved Black Americans. But as I mentioned before, I mean, this is, birthright citizenship becomes the basis for people of all kind of backgrounds, people of all racial, ethnic backgrounds, being able to, you know, enter the United States, become citizens, and exercise rights under the law. And to be very clear, you know, historians talk about this all the time. U.S. citizenship isn't everything, and history shows that it hasn't guaranteed equal treatment or protection. For example, you could think about Jim Crow, the treatment of Black Americans for so much of U.S. history. Within Asian American history, you know, the World War II incarceration of more than 125,000 Japanese Americans is really an example, because two-thirds of those Japanese Americans who were incarcerated between 1942 and 1945, two-thirds of them were U.S.-born citizens in the 1940s. And so we know that U.S. citizenship isn't everything, but without it, true equality isn't possible. It's the starting point of true democracy and equality of opportunity. And so that's why this principle, which has been, you know, on the books since the 1860s, that's why it's so important.
Yeah. And at the same time, the Supreme Court's now deliberating on whether Trump's order is constitutional. You know, what precedent do you think their decision will set for the course of history, Jane?
I mean, I think, you know, I think the, this really brings me back to the importance of the 1964 Civil Rights Act and the 1965 Voting Rights Act, because, you know, a lot of what folks today take for granted, which is that people of all different backgrounds in the United States have rights and can exercise rights under law. This kind of post-civil rights order is, it's relatively recent. You know, it really has been over the last 60 years. And so for folks like myself who were born after 1964, 1965, it's kind of all folks have known. And if the Supreme Court does reverse or try to undo birthright citizenship, we're going to see a very different kind of understanding of U.S. citizenship and a very different understanding of what the United States is potentially emerging. And so I think folks have to understand the kind of weightiness and the importance of kind of what that decision could possibly mean for us and also for our children and kind of the future.
And the timing of digging into history like this is pretty special, too. It's Asian American, Native Hawaiian, Pacific Islander Heritage Month. So what do you think of the importance of highlighting Asian stories like the ones that you told, like that of Wong Kim Ark, for instance, especially right now?
Yeah, I mean, I think what I often say is that, you know, Asian American histories, Native Hawaiian histories, Pacific Islander histories, I mean, they're U.S. histories. And so when I think about histories of U.S. citizenship, when I think about histories of migration, histories of immigration law in the United States, histories of just, you know, history of this country.
Yeah.
I think these histories are part of that history. They are U.S. history. And I will say, you know, I taught a 2-week National Endowment for Humanities seminar last summer on AANHPI histories, and we brought together 36 high school teachers from across the United States, from Alaska, so continental U.S., mm-hmm. Alaska, American Samoa, Hong Kong, and these were teachers, you know, that were just spending 2 weeks of their summers learning these histories from experts and bringing these histories back to their own classrooms in different parts of the country and across the world, really. And that was one of the most meaningful and powerful experiences, I think, of my entire teaching life.
Wow.
And I think it was just an amazing time. And so it makes, you know, what's happening now with the National Endowment for the Humanities, you know, deeply painful to watch. Yeah. So
something that's also on the chopping block.
Yeah, so the NEH seminars, exactly. The NEH seminars for this upcoming summer have been canceled. And so it's really unclear what the future will be of the NEH. And so, I just hope that folks can understand kind of why these decisions and why these court cases and why these histories actually matter.
Because
they shape. Shape our society.
We'll leave it there. Jane Hong's Associate Professor of History at Occidental College. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This episode of the Reset Podcast was produced by Ellie Gilbert-Bear and edited by Meha Ahmed. It was mixed by Ari Mejia. If you like our conversations, we hope you stay with us and keep listening. You can subscribe to the show wherever you listen or on our website at wbez.org/reset. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. Thanks so much.
My name is Donald. I live on the southeast side of Chicago. I support WBEZ because of the balanced reporting and covering so much about an issue as opposed to just the few seconds that you may hear on most other news outlets. It matters to me to hear the story more completely.